He slept poorly, and at the end of a long night he had another dream about John. They were in the long, drafty, upcurved chambers of the space station, spinning at Martian gravity in their long stay of 2010. 6 weeks together up there, young and strong. John saying, "I feel like Superman. This gravity's great. I feel like Superman." Running laps around the big ring of the station hallway. "Everything's gonna change on Mars, Frank. Everything." No. Each step was like the last jump of a triple jump. Boing, 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 boing. Yes, the whole question will be learning to run fast enough. A perfect interference pattern of cloud dots lay pasted over the western coast of Madagascar, the sun bronzing the ocean below. Everything looks so fine from up here. "Get any closer and you begin to see too much," Frank murmured. "Or not enough." It was cold. They argued over the temperature. John was from Minnesota and had slept as a boy with his window open. So Frank shivered, a down coverlet draped over his shoulders, his feet blocks of ice. They played chess, and Frank won. John laughed. "How stupid," he said. "What do you mean?" "Games don't mean anything." "Are you sure?" "Sometimes life seems like a kind of game to me." John shook his head. "In games, there are rules, but in life, the rules keep changing. You could put your bishop out there to mate the other guy's king, and he could lean down and whisper in your bishop's ear, and suddenly it's playing for him, and moving like a rook, and you're fucked." Frank nodded. He had taught these things to John. A confusion of meals, chess, talk, the view of the rolling earth. It felt like the only life they had ever lived. The voices from Houston were like AIs, their concerns absurd. The planet itself was so beautiful, so intricately patterned by its land and its clouds. "I never want to go down. I mean, this is almost better than Mars'll be, don't you think?" "No." Huddled, shivering, listening to John talk of boyhood, girls, sports, dreams of space, Frank responded with tales of Washington, lessons from Machiavelli, until it occurred to him that John was formidable enough as it was. Friendship was just diplomacy by other means, after all. But later, after a vague blur, talking, halting, shivering, talking about his father, coming home drunk from the Jacksonville bars, Priscilla and her white blonde hair, her fashion magazine face. How it meant nothing to him anymore. A marriage for the resume, for looking normal to the shrinks without holding him down, and not his fault. Abandoned, after all. Betrayed. That sounds bad. No wonder you think people are so fucked. Frank waved at their big blue lamp. But they are. Waving by coincidence at the Horn of Africa. Think about what's happened down there. That's history, Frank. We can do better than that. Can we? Can we? You just wait and see. He woke up, his stomach knotted, his skin sweaty. He got up and took a shower. Already he could remember no more than a single fragment of the dream. John saying, "Wait and see." But his stomach was like wood. After breakfast, he clicked his fork on the table, thinking. All that day he spent distracted, wandering as if still in a dream, wondering from time to time how one told the difference. Wasn't this life dreamlike in every significant respect? Everything overlit, bizarre, symbolic of something else? That evening, he went looking for Maya, feeling helpless, in the grip of a compulsion. The decision had been made the night before, when Janet said, "She loves you, you know." And he turned a corner to the dining commons, and there she was, her head thrown back in the middle of her pealing laugh, vividly Maya, her hair as white as it had once been black, her eyes fixed on her companion, a man, dark-haired, handsome, perhaps in his 50s, smiling at her. Maya put a hand to his upper arm, a characteristic gesture, one of her usual intimacies. It meant nothing, and in fact indicated that he was not her lover, but rather someone she was in the process of enchanting. They could have met just minutes before, although the look on his face indicated he knew her better than that. She turned and saw Frank, blinked with surprise. She looked back at the man and continued to speak in Russian, her hand still on his arm. Frank hesitated and almost turned and left. Silently, he cursed himself. Was he no more than a schoolboy, then? He walked by them and said hello, didn't hear if they replied. All through the dinner, she stayed glued to the man's side, not looking his way, not coming over. The man, pleasant enough looking, was surprised at her attention. Surprised, but pleased. Clearly they would leave together. Clearly they would spend the night together. That foreknowledge always made people pleasant. She would use people like that without a qualm, the bitch. Love. The more he thought about it, the angrier he got. She had never loved anyone but herself, and yet, that look on her face when she first saw him. For a split second, hadn't she been pleased, and then wanted him angry at her? And wasn't that a sign of hurt feelings? Of a desire to hurt back, meaning a certain, incredibly childish, desire for him. Well, the hell with her. He went back to his room and packed his bag and took the subway to the train station and got on a night train west, up Tharsis to Pavonis Mons. In a few months' time, when the elevator was maneuvered into its remarkable orbit, Pavonis Mons was going to become the hub of Mars, superseding Burrows as Burrows had once superseded Underhill. And as the elevator's touchdown wasn't far off, signs of the area's coming predominance were already everywhere. Paralleling the train piste as it ascended the steep eastern slope of the volcano were two new roads and four thick pipelines, as well as an array of cables, a line of microwave towers, and a continuous litter of stations, loading tracks, warehouses, and dumps. And then on the last and steepest upcurve of the volcano's cone, there was a vast congregation of tents and industrial buildings, thicker and thicker until up on the broad rim they were everywhere, and between them immense fields of insulation capture sheets and receivers for the energy microwave down from the orbiting solar panels. Each tent along the way was a little town, stuffed with little apartment blocks, and each apartment block was stuffed with people, their laundry hanging from every window. The tents nearest the piste had very few trees in them and looked like commercial districts. Frank caught quick glimpses of food stands, video rentals, open-front gyms, clothing stores, laundromats. Litter piled in the streets. Then he was into the train station on the rim and out of the train and into the spacious tent of the station. The south rim had a tremendous view over the great caldera, an immense, nearly circular hole, flawless except for a single giant scoop bursting out of the rim to the northeast. This scoop formed a great gap across the caldera from the station, the mark of a truly huge sideways explosion. But that was the only flaw in the design. Otherwise, the cliff was regular and the floor of the caldera was almost perfectly round, almost perfectly flat. And 60 kilometers across and a full 5,000 meters deep, like the start of the mohole to end all moholes. The few signs of human presence on the caldera floor were on an ant scale, almost invisible from the rim. The equator ran right across the southern rim, and that was where they were going to secure the lower end of the elevator. The attachment point was obvious. It was a massive tan-and-white concrete blockhouse located a few kilometers west of the big tent town around the train station. Running west along the rim beyond the blockhouse was a line of factories and earth movers and cones of feedstock materials, all gleaming with photographic clarity in the clear, dustless, thin, high air, under a sky that was a kind of plum black. There were a number of stars near the zenith that were visible by day. The day after his arrival, the staff of the local department office took him out to the elevator base. Apparently, technicians were going to capture the leader line from the cable that afternoon. This turned out to be unspectacular, but it was a peculiar sight nevertheless. The end of the leader line was marked by a small guidance rocket, and this rocket's eastern-facing jets flared continuously, while the north and south jets added occasional spurts. The rocket thus descended slowly into the grasp of a gantry, looking like any other landing vehicle, except that there was a silver line extending up from it, a straight, fine line that was only visible for a couple thousand meters above the rocket. Looking at it, Frank felt as if he were standing on a sea floor and observing a fishing line drop down among them from the plum sea surface, a fishing line tied to a bright, colorful lure in the process of snagging on a bottom wreck. His blood burned in his throat, and he had to look down and breathe deep. Very peculiar. They toured the base complex. The gantry that had captured the leader line was located inside a big hole in the concrete block, a concrete crater with a thick ring of a rim. The walls of this concrete crater were studded by curved silver columns which held magnetic coils that would fix the cable butt in a shock cushioning collar. The cable would float well off the concrete floor of the chamber, suspended there by the pull of the outer half of the cable. An exquisitely balanced orbit, an object extending from a moonlit down into this room, 37,000 kilometers in all, and only 10 meters across. With the leader line secured, the cable itself could be guided down fairly easily, but not rapidly, as it had to drift down into its final orbit very gently indeed, in an asymptotic approach. "It's going to be like Zeno's paradox," Sluzinski said. So it was many days after that visit when the butt of the cable finally appeared in the sky and hung there. Over the next few weeks it descended ever more slowly, always there in the sky. A very odd sight indeed. It gave Frank a touch of vertigo, and every time he saw it, the image of standing on an ocean floor returned to him. They were looking up at a fishing line, a black thread hanging down from the plum sea surface. Frank spent this time setting up the head department of Mars offices in the town, which one day was christened Sheffield. The borough's staff protested the move, but he ignored them. He spent his time meeting with American executives and project managers, all at work on various aspects of the elevator or Sheffield, or the outlying Pavonis towns. Americans represented only a fraction of the workforce on hand, but Chalmers was kept busy nevertheless because the overall project was so huge, and Americans appeared to be dominating the superconducting and the software involved with the actual elevator cars, a coup that was worth billions and which many people gave Frank credit for, though it was in fact his AI and Sluzinski who were responsible, along with Phyllis. Many of the Americans lived out in a tent town east of Sheffield called Texas, sharing the space with internationals who liked the idea of Texas, or had just ended up there randomly. Frank met with as many of them as he could so that by the time the cable touched down, they would be organized and working with a coherent policy, or under his thumb, as some of them put it, but happy to be there as long as it gave them any clout. They knew they were less powerful than the East Asian Commonwealth, which was building the elevator car shells, and less powerful than the EEC, which had constructed the cable itself, and less powerful than Praxis, and Amex, and Arms Corps, and Subarashi. Eventually the day came when the cable was going to touch down. A giant crowd gathered in Sheffield to see it. The train station concourse was jammed to well over capacity, as it had a good view along the rim to the base complex, popularly referred to as the socket. As the hours passed, the end of the black column drifted downward, moving more and more slowly as it approached its target. There it hung, not that much bigger than the leader line guiding it down, smaller, in fact, than the business end of an Energia rocket. It stood up into the sky perfectly vertical, but it was so thin and the foreshortening was so severe that it looked not much longer than a tall skyscraper, a very skinny tall skyscraper, walking on air, a black tree trunk taller than the sky. "We ought to be right under it, down on the floor of the socket," one of his staff said. "There'd be headroom when it stops, right?" "Magnetic field might scramble you a bit," Sluzinski replied, never taking his gaze from the sky. As it got closer, they saw that the cable was knobbed with various protrusions and filigreed with silver lines. The gap under it got smaller. Then the end of it disappeared into the base complex, and the seashell roar of the crowd in the concourse grew louder. People watched the TVs closely. Cameras inside the socket showed the cable come to a slow halt, still 10 meters above the concrete floor. After that came the tweezer-like movement of gantries and the clamping of a physical collar around the cable, a few meters up from its end. Everything happened in dreamlike slow motion, and when it was done, it looked like the round socket room had suddenly gained an ill-fitting black roof. Over the loudspeaker system, a woman's voice said, "The elevator is secured." There was a brief cheer. People moved away from the TVs and looked out the tent walls again. Now the object looked much less strange than it had when hanging out of the sky. Now it was nothing more than the reductio ad absurdum of Martian architecture. A very slender, very tall black spire. A beanstalk. Peculiar, but not so unsettling. The crowd burst into 1,000 conversations and scattered. And not long after that, the elevators were working. During the years when the cable was extruding from Clark, robots had been spidering along it, constructing the power lines, safety cables, generators, superconducting pistes, maintenance stations, defense stations, position adjustment rockets, fuel tanks, and emergency shelters that marked the cable every few kilometers. This work had proceeded at the same pace as the cable construction itself, so that soon after touchdown, the cars were running up and down, 400 of them going in each direction, like parasites on a strand of hair. And a few months after that, you could take an elevator into orbit, and you could take another elevator down out of orbit to the surface. And down they came, transported from Earth by the fleet of continuous shuttles, those big spaceships that boomed around the Earth-Venus-Mars system, using the three planets and Luna as gravity handles, fielding madly accelerating ferry packets from Earth and Mars. Each of the 13 operating ships held 1,000 people, and they were full every trip out. So there was a continuous stream of people docking on Clark, descending in elevator cars, and debarking in the socket. And then pouring into Sheffield's concourses, wild and unsteady and bug-eyed as they were herded with some difficulty to the train station and onto trains outbound. Most of these trains then emptied their loads into the Pavonis tent towns. Robot crews were building the tents just fast enough to house the influx, and the completion of 2 new pipelines had secured the water supply on Pavonis, which was being pumped up from the Compton Aquifer beneath Noctis Labyrinthus. So the emigrants settled in. Back in the socket, on the other side of the cable, upbound elevator cars were being loaded with refined metals, platinum, gold, uranium, and silver. Then the cars swung in and locked onto the piste, and up they rose again, accelerating slowly to their full speed of 300 kilometers an hour. 5 days later, they arrived at the top of the cable, and decelerated into locks inside the ballast asteroid Clark, now a much-tunneled chunk of carbonaceous chondrite, so filigreed with exterior buildings and interior chambers that it seemed more a spaceship or a city than Mars's third moon. It was a busy place. There was a continuous procession of incoming and outgoing ships and crews perpetually in transit, as well as a large force of local traffic controllers using some of the most powerful AIs in existence. Though most of the operations involving the cable were computer-controlled and robotically accomplished, entire human professions were springing up to direct and oversee all these efforts. And, of course, media coverage of all the new imagery was immediate and intense. And, all in all, despite the decade of waiting, it seemed that on touchdown, the elevator had sprung into being like Athena. But there was trouble. Frank found that his staff was spending more and more time dealing with men and women from the tents who had come into Sheffield and right into their offices, new arrivals who were sometimes nervous, sometimes loud and angry, rattling on about crowded living conditions or insufficient police or bad food. One bulky red-faced man wearing a baseball cap shook a finger at them and said, "Private security companies come in from tents higher up and offer protection, but they're just gangs. It's just extortion. I can't even give you my name or our security might find out I came here. I mean, I believe in the black economy as much as the next guy, but this is crazy. This isn't what we came here for." Frank paced his office, seething. These kinds of allegations were clearly true, but difficult to verify without a security team of one's own. A big police force, in fact. When the man left, he grilled his staff, but they could tell him nothing new, which made him even angrier. "You're paid to find these things out for me. That's your jobs. What are you doing sitting around in here all day watching Terran news?" He canceled a day's appointments, 37 meetings in all. "Lazy, incompetent bastards," he said loudly as he stalked out the door. He went to the train station and caught a local downslope to have a look for himself. The local train now stopped every kilometer of the descent in small stainless steel locks that served as stations for the tent towns. He got out in one. Signs in the lock identified it as El Paso. He walked through the open doors of the passage lock. At least these tents had a view. There was no denying that. Down the great eastern slope of the volcano ran the train piste and the pipelines, and on either side of them tent after tent, like blisters. The clear fabric of the older ones upslope was already turning a bit purple. Ventilators hummed loudly from the physical plant next to the station, and from somewhere a hydrazine generator was adding its high hum. People were conversing in Spanish and English. Frank called his office and got them to ring the apartment of a man from El Paso who had dropped in to complain. The man answered, and Frank arranged to meet him at a cafe next to the station, then walked over and sat at an outer table. Men and women sat around tables, eating and talking like anywhere else. Little electric cars hummed up and down the narrow streets, most piled high with boxes. The buildings near the station were three stories tall and appeared prefab, steel-reinforced concrete painted bright blue and white. There was a line of young trees in tubs running away from the station down the main thoroughfare. Small groups sat on the astroturf, or walked aimlessly from shop to shop, or hurried with shoulder bags and day packs toward the station. All of them looked a bit disoriented or uncertain, as if they had no habits or had not yet learned to walk properly. The man showed up with a whole crowd of his neighbors, all in their 20s, too young to be on Mars, or so it used to be said. Perhaps the treatment could fix damage from radiation, allow them to reproduce accurately, who could say for sure till they tried? Laboratory animals, that's what they were, what they had always been. It was strange to stand among them like some ancient patriarch, treated with a mixture of awe and condescension, like a grandpa. Irritably, he told them to take him on a walk and show him around. They guided him down narrow streets away from the station and the taller buildings, between long rows of what turned out to be agee huts, which had been designed for temporary shelter in the outlands, research outposts or water stations or refugee huts, now lined up by the score. The slope of the volcano had been hastily graded, and a lot of the huts were on a 2 or 3 degree slope so that they had to be careful in the kitchens, they said, and make sure to align their beds properly. Frank asked them what they did. "Stevedores in Sheffield," most replied, "offloading the elevator cars and getting the stuff on trains." Robots were supposed to do it, but it was surprising how much labor remained in the process for human muscle. Heavy equipment operators, robot programmers, machine repairmen, Waldo dwarves, construction workers. Most of them had rarely gotten out onto the surface. Some of them never had. They had done similar kinds of work back home or had been unemployed. This was their chance. Most wanted to return to Earth someday, but the gyms were crowded and expensive and time-consuming, and they were all losing their tone. They had southern accents that Frank hadn't heard since childhood. It was like hearing voices from a previous century, like listening to Elizabethans. Did people still talk that way? TV never revealed it. "Y'all been here so long you don't mind being indoors, but I can't stand it. I can't stand it." Frank glared into a kitchen. "What do you eat?" he demanded. "Fish, vegetables, rice, tofu. It all came in bulk packages. They had no complaints. They thought it was good. Americans, the most degraded palates in history. Somebody give me a cheeseburger." No, what they minded was the confinement, the lack of privacy, the teleoperation, the crowding together, and the resulting problems. "All my stuff got stole the day after I got here." "Me too, me too." Theft, assault, extortion. The criminals all came from other tent towns, they said. Russians, they said. White folks with strange talk. Some black folks, too, but not so many here as at home. A woman had been raped the previous week. "You're kidding," Frank said. "What do you mean, you're kidding?" one woman said, disgusted with him. Eventually, they led him back to the station. Pausing in the door, Frank didn't know what to say to them. Quite a crowd had gathered, as people had recognized him or been called or drawn to the group. "I'll see what I can do," he muttered, and ducked through the passage lock. Thoughtlessly, he stared into tents as he rode a train back up. There was one fitted with coffin hotels, Tokyo style. That would be much more crowded than El Paso, but did its occupants care about that? Some people were used to being treated like ball bearings. A lot of people, in fact. But on Mars, it was supposed to be different. Back in Sheffield, he stalked the rim concourse, staring out at the thin vertical line of the elevator, ignoring other people and forcing some of them to jump out of his way as he paced. Once he stopped and looked around at the crowd. There were perhaps 500 people in view at that moment, living their lives. When had it gotten like this? They had been a scientific outpost, a handful of researchers, scattered over a world with as much land surface as the Earth. A whole Eurasia, Africa, America, Australia, and Antarctica, all for them. All that land was still out there, but what percentage of it was under tents and habitable? Much less than 1%. And yet, what was Unoma saying? 1 million people here already, with more on the way, and no police, and crime, or rather crime without police. 1 million people, and no law. No law, but corporate law. The bottom line. Minimize expenses, maximize profits. Run smoothly on ball bearings. The next week, the people in a set of tents on the south slope went on strike. Chalmers heard about it on his way to the office, Slezinski actually breaking in on his walk with a call. The striking tents were mostly American, and his staff was in a panic. "They've closed the stations and aren't allowing anyone off the train, so they can't be controlled unless their emergency locks are stormed. Shut up!" Frank went down the south piece to the striking tents, ignoring Slezinski's objections. In fact, he ordered several of the staff down to join him. A team from Sheffield Security was standing in the station, but he ordered them to get on the train and leave, and after a consultation with the Sheffield administrators, they did. At the passage lock, he identified himself and asked to come in alone. They let him through. He emerged in the main square of another tent, surrounded by a sea of angry faces. "Kill the TVs," he suggested. "Let's talk in private." They killed the TVs. It was the same as in El Paso. Different accents, but the same complaints. His earlier visit gave him the ability to anticipate what they were going to say it before they did. He watched grimly as their faces revealed how impressed they were by this ability. They were young. "Look, it's a bad situation," he said after they had talked for an hour. "But if you strike for long, you'll only make it worse. They'll send in security, and it won't be like living with gangs and police among you. It'll be like living in prison. You've made your point already, and now you've got to know when to let off and negotiate. Form a committee to represent you and make a list of complaints and demands. Document all the incidents of crime. Just write them down and get the victims to sign the statements. I'll make good use of them. It's going to take work at Unoma and back home, because they're breaking the treaty." He paused to get control of himself, relax his jaw. "Meanwhile, get back to work. It'll pass the time better than sitting around cooped up in here, and it'll make you points for the negotiation. And if you don't, they'll maybe just cut off your food and make you. Better to do it of your own free will and look like rational negotiators." So the strike ended. They even gave him a ragged round of applause when he went back out into the station. He got on the train in a blinding fury, refusing to acknowledge any of his staff's questions or their mute looks of idiot inquiry, and savaging the head of the security team, who was an arrogant fool. "If you corrupt bastards had any integrity, this wouldn't have happened. You're nothing but a protection racket. Why are people getting assaulted in the tents? Why are they paying protection? Where are you when all this is happening?" "It's not our jurisdiction," the man said, white-lipped. "Oh, come on, what is your jurisdiction? Your pocket is your only jurisdiction." He went on until the security men got up and left the car, as angry at him as he was at them, but too disciplined or scared to talk back. In the Sheffield offices, he strode from room to room, shouting at the staff and making calls. Sachs, Vlad, Janet. He told them what was happening, and they all eventually offered the same suggestion, which he had to admit was a good one. He would have to go up the elevator and talk to Phyllis. "See if you can manage the reservations," he said to his staff. The elevator was like an old Amsterdam house, narrow and tall, with a light-filled room at the top. In this case, a clear-walled and domed chamber that reminded Frank of the bubble dome of the Ares. On the second day of the trip, he joined the car's other passengers, only 20 on this one, there weren't too many people going this way, and they took the car's own little interior elevator up the 30 stories to this clear penthouse to see Phobos pass. The outer perimeter of the room was set out over the elevator proper, so there was a view down as well. Frank stared down at the curved line of the planet's horizon, much whiter and thicker than the last time he had seen it. Atmosphere at 150 millibars now. Really quite impressive, even if it was composed of poison gas. While they were waiting for the little moon's appearance, Frank stared at the planet below. The gossamer arrow of the cable pointed straight down at it. It looked like they were rising on a tall, slender rocket. A strange, attenuated rocket which stretched some kilometers above and below them. That was all they would ever see of the cable. And below them, the round orange floor of Mars looked just as blank as it had on their first approach so long ago, unchanged despite all their meddling. One only had to get far enough away. Then one of the elevator pilots pointed out Phobos, a dim white object to the west. In 10 minutes it was upon them, flashing past with astonishing speed, a large gray potato hurtling faster than the head could turn. Zip! Gone! The observers in the penthouse hooted, exclaimed, chattered. Frank had caught only the merest glimpse of the dome on Stickney, winking like a gem in the rock. And there had been a piece banding the middle like a wedding ring, and some bright silver lumps. That was all he could recall of the blurred image. 50 kilometers away when it passed, the pilot said. At 7,000 kilometers an hour. Not all that fast, actually. There were meteors that hit the planet at 50,000 kilometers an hour. But fast enough. Frank went back down to the dining floor, trying to fix the hurtling image in his mind. Phobos. People at the dining table next to him talked of shoving it up into a braided orbit with Deimos. It was out of the loop now, a new Azores, nothing but an inconvenience to the cable. And Phyllis had argued all along that Mars itself would have suffered the same fate in the solar system at large unless the elevator were built to climb its gravity well. They would have been bypassed by miners going to the metal-rich asteroids, which had no gravity wells to contend with. And then there were the moons of Jupiter, Saturn, the outer planets. But there was no danger of that now.